anyone alive. As he pondered how to move forward now that his top agents in Hondonia had been removed, he decided to take a more active role. The more he studied the case of the lone Indian, the more he believed he had found a conflict that perfectly encapsulated the tensions he had seen coming to a head throughout the Amazon for decades. Chapter 12. Larger Than Life. In 1959, Sidney Pozuelo was 18 years old and itching for adventure. Up to that point, he'd lived in the suburbs of Sao Paulo, wishing he were somewhere else. When his friends wanted to play soccer, he wanted to run around with his slingshot through a little tract of woods. He would spend hours reading about Brazil's wild open spaces in O Cruzeiro magazine, and then dream of slashing his way through ropey jungles, mapping uncharted territory, discovering new lands. The city where he lived was enormous, but life there seemed small. Even as a kid, Sidney had a taste for the epic. To put those dreams to the test, the teenager boarded a small military plane that delivered mail to Brazil's backcountry, and he strapped into the rear along with the boxes and envelopes. He was headed for the new Xingu National Park, which was little more than a big blotch on the map, a clumsy spill of green ink. The only people who lived there were Indians, and it was about to be explored by the most famous adventurers of the day, the Vilas Boas brothers. The four siblings were ethnologists who had been traversing the wildest landscapes of South America. For months, Sidney had been writing them, begging to join their team. He had discovered where their sister lived in Sao Paulo and staked out the house. He became a hovering gadfly, offering to help her out in whatever way an anxious teenager with unlimited energy could, just for a chance to meet the men he already had grown to consider heroes. When the brothers visited her, he'd run to the store to buy them cigarettes. He was desperate for adventure, and they finally surrendered. When the plane landed, it skidded toward the edge of the landing strip, burrowing nose first through the mud. A storm of envelopes settled around Sidney as it shuddered to a halt. He and the plane's other passenger, a sergeant in Brazil's army, jumped out of the hatch and were greeted by a man who quickly fetched a tractor to help haul the plane out of the mud and onto more solid ground. The man hooked one end of a steel cable to the tractor, and the army sergeant hooked the other end to the plane's tiny rear wheel. But before the army sergeant had securely fixed the cable to the plane, the man with the tractor started to pull away. Sidney, standing next to the sergeant, watched the cable pull taut. The sergeant's finger got caught between the wheel and the cable, and it popped off into the mud at Sidney's feet, completely severed. Sidney ran for help, straight to an outpost near the landing strip. There, he experienced his first of countless encounters with Amazonian Indians. He slipped in the mud just as he reached the outpost and commenced a long and comically dramatic fall, feet scissoring in search of something solid, arms pinwheeling for balance, mouth agape. He landed with a splat. Pulling himself up, he saw 100 Kayapo tribesmen laughing at him. His first impression of Amazonian Indians was precise and unequivocal. Sons of bitches. One of the most celebrated careers in the history of Brazilian adventure began, embarrassingly, with mumbled curses. Sidney had entered his line of work for adventure, plain and simple. Indians were an afterthought. It was his relationship with his mentor, Orlando Vilas Boas, that began to change all that. The Vilas Boas brothers are believed to be the first non-missionaries to live permanently with Amazonian Indians. Starting in the 1950s, Orlando, particularly, was cast by Brazil's media as a latter-day incarnation of the revered explorer and national hero Cândido Rondon. In fact, near the end of his life, Rondon had tapped the Vilas Boas brothers as his protégés. When Sidney landed in the jungle, the brothers were laying the groundwork to create South America's first-ever Indian reserve, the 1,200-square-mile Xingu Territory. It is about the size of New Jersey and Connecticut combined. For years, the brothers had been pushing the idea of reserves, telling authorities that the Indians deserved a land buffer to protect them from modern society. Like most of the indigenous who came of age in their wake, Sidney adopted the Vilas Boas philosophy. The Indians might have to adapt to the modern world, but they should be the ones to set the pace of that change. Before Orlando Vilas Boas died at age 88 in 2002, he'd been awarded highest honors for humanitarian work given by a wide-ranging cast of international entities, from the Royal Geographic Society in London to the government of Germany. But Orlando also had collected more dangerous laurels, and those were the ones that had seized Sidney's imagination and led him to follow the same path. Some of Orlando's most obvious battle scars came from his bouts with malaria, and he wasn't shy about letting people know about them. He claimed that he'd battled the disease more than 250 times during his career as an explorer and Indian advocate. During his own career of more than 40 years as an explorer, Sidney, who called himself the tick on Orlando's neck, never let a bout of malarial shivers pass him by without adding it to his own personal tally. The malarial count became a sort of measuring stick for his adventuring. Sidney could easily awe new acquaintances with stories about one of his encounters with isolated tribes in the middle of the jungle, but he'd abruptly stop himself if his listeners appeared too wonderstruck. "You know, Orlando had malaria more than 200 times, Sidney would say, trying to inject some sobering context to the conversation. "I've only had it 39 times so far." He'd appear coy and diffident, but he clearly viewed bouts with tropical disease as badges of honor, and he wore them as proudly as the cylindrical vial of anti-malarial medicine that dangled from the chain encircling his neck. By 2000, Sidney's thinning curly hair and wildly unkempt beard were flecked with gray, and his face displayed the seams of a hard-lived life. Back in the 1970s, during a run-in with a colonist, 5 of his teeth had been knocked out by the butt of the man's revolver. In the 1980s, he'd been kidnapped by Mentuktire tribesmen, who were angry at Funai's plan to reduce the size of their portion of the Xingu Reserve. He'd broken ribs during crash airplane landings, and during his expeditions over the years, he'd seen 8 of his men die. His left eyeball had literally popped out during a motorcycle crash in 1998, but it had nothing to do with jungle exploration. He'd been visiting the Tuareg, a nomadic tribe in the Sahara, after traveling to the region to receive a humanitarian medal from the King of Morocco. In the early 1990s, Sidney had served briefly as Funai's president, but gave up the post to return to his true passion, leading Funai's Isolated Indians Division, which he'd founded in 1987. He still traveled regularly, but his home base was in Brasilia, in one of the city's boxy high-rise apartment buildings. Pictures from his expeditions hung on the walls, but they weren't the defining features of the decor. Don Quixote statues sat on tabletops. Don Quixote paintings hung on the walls. Various editions of Cervantes's 17th-century epic sat on shelves. Sidney had a soft spot for epic quests, and no story had resonated with him like the one about the idealistic man from La Mancha. He'd first read it when he was 8 or 9 years old, in a Portuguese edition that had been abridged for children. When he reread it as a teenager, the image of Don Quixote had been fixed in his head as a model of virtue. A man who always fought for what he believed was right, even if the whole world thought he was insane. Don Quixote believed he could change the world, and Sidney couldn't imagine anything more heroic. There was a simple elegance to the knight's code, fighting for justice, defending the weak, tipping the hat to the ladies. Even if the rest of the world considered such things to be the oxidized remnants of a bygone era, Sidney believed those were the terms on which life should be led. Fighting for the good of the country's tribes became his noble quest, and he plunged himself into the role with complete dedication. Some of his colleagues in Funai rolled their eyes at his theatrical romanticism, but he didn't care. Each of his three ex-wives came to realize in their own time that he'd found his true love early in life. Despite his charm and chivalry, his heart had already been claimed by Indians and his quest to help them. He cut himself free of his marriages as if he were clearing a jungle trail with a slash of his machete. If someone asked him about his three ex-wives, he responded, "They don't make Penelopes anymore." Marcelo, Altair, and some of their peers had looked up to Sidney as a Sertanista, but they didn't always agree with his take-no-prisoners style. For years, they'd sent him expedition reports and update him on the latest twist in the trail of the lone Indian, and Sidney's reaction was usually the same. Push it. Make contact before the loggers do. Sidney had become famous for advocating an official policy of protecting Indians by leaving them alone, a philosophy that more than one writer had labeled quixotic. But he believed the lone Indian faced an imminent threat to his life, and it was only a matter of time before he succumbed. Sometimes there were exceptions to the rules, Sidney believed. The lone Indian needed to be saved. As the last of his tribe, he was an extreme case, practically unique in the world's history. In the early 1800s, the Indians of the island of San Nicolas, about 70 miles off the coast of California, were reduced from about 300 members to just 7. Alaskan fur traders had decimated the tribe when the waters surrounding the island proved rich with otters and seals. In 1835, a group of padres from a Catholic mission in Santa Barbara, California, commissioned a schooner to fetch the survivors and ferry them back to the mission. According to some 19th-century accounts of the rescue, just minutes after departing from the rocky coast of the island with the Indians on board, they realized that one baby had been left behind. The captain of the boat decided that turning around in the stormy surf wasn't worth the risk. Desperate, the baby's mother jumped overboard and swam toward the island's windswept coast. The men aboard the boat quickly lost sight of her. She was believed dead, drowned in a roiling sea. Other accounts, less dramatic but perhaps more likely, suggested that the schooner's crew simply left one Indian behind. They hurriedly departed from the island in the face of a mounting storm without doing a careful head count of the Indians. Either way, 18 years later, an otter hunter reported seeing human footprints on the otherwise uninhabited island. Whether she had swum to shore from the boat or simply was left behind by the crew, one woman was living alone there. She had outlived everyone from her tribe. All those who had been successfully transported to the mission had died by the time the otter hunter found her footprints. A search party arrived on the island in the summer of 1853 and found her, dressed in cormorant feathers, skinning a seal. She appeared to be about 50 years old, and she spoke a dialect that was all her own. If a baby had ever been with her, that baby was now dead. With only a sparse selection of foliage, mostly roots and tubers, to eat, the woman had survived by hunting and foraging in the island's tidal pools, eating shellfish and seals. She had weathered nearly 2 decades of violent storms and isolation. She was transported to the mission. A priest baptized her and gave her the name Juana Maria. She quickly became a local curiosity and wowed visiting audiences with her singing and dancing. But just weeks after arriving at the mission, she developed dysentery and died before the details of her survival could be pieced together. 58 years later, the last wild Indian in America was discovered near Oroville, California. He was from the Yahi tribe, a group whose population dropped sharply during the gold rush. A massacre at the hands of cattlemen in 1865 left only 30 survivors. Over the next 40 years, the Yahi dwindled in number until, in November 1908, a single Indian stood alone. He appeared to be about 50 years old. He remained without human companionship until the morning of August 29, 1911, when barking dogs outside of a slaughterhouse awoke a group of butchers and alerted them to an emaciated man crouching against the corral fence, wearing nothing but a scrap of covered wagon canvas. The local sheriff locked him in the Oroville jail. The wild man of Deer Creek was an instant sensation. Newspapers detailed how he'd been plucked straight from the Stone Age and deposited into the modern world. An anthropologist from the University of California at Berkeley named Alfred Kroeber read the articles and was reminded of the stories he'd heard about the lone woman of San Nicolas. Kroeber sent a telegram to the sheriff requesting that the university take custody of the Indian. Kroeber's colleague, anthropology professor Thomas Waterman, traveled to the jail and discovered that the Indian spoke a dialect of Yana, a language that Waterman had studied. The anthropologists transferred the Indian to San Francisco, where they began to decipher his history. 3 years earlier, surveyors had found a village inhabited by 4 Yahi Indians: the man, his mother, his sister, and an elderly male. The Indian and his mother hid, undetected by the surveyors, while his sister and the old man fled, never to be seen again. The surviving Indian later told the anthropologists that he believed his sister and the old man died soon after. Either they had drowned while trying to cross a creek, or had been eaten by mountain lions or another predator. His mother died almost immediately after they were forced to abandon their village, he said. On the university's campus, the anthropologists outfitted the Indian in modern clothes, dressing him in pants, a button-down shirt, a coat, and a tie. He lived in the new anthropology museum alongside the mummified remains of Egyptians and the skulls and bones of other Native Americans. The fact that the Indian didn't have a name quickly posed problems. Kroeber, knowing that California Indians almost never spoke their own name, told reporters that assigning the man a name was inappropriate and futile. But that explanation didn't satisfy public demand that the Indian be named, so Kroeber reluctantly called him Ishi, the Yana word for man. Ishi privately plucked his facial hairs with tweezers he made of split wood, refusing to imitate the white man's preference for beards. In his first days at the museum, he explained that he felt himself an outsider in his new world. "I am one, you are others. This is in the inevitable nature of things," was how Kroeber translated his view of life with his newfound acquaintances. Soon, vaudeville impresarios and carnival companies flooded Kroeber with offers to take Ishi on the road. Motion picture companies clamored for a chance to film him. The museum was swamped with visitors wanting to take pictures and shake the hand of a living, breathing Stone Age relic. The man who had spent almost 3 years with no human contact was suddenly surrounded by clamoring crowds. He had literally become a museum exhibit. His public appearances at the museum were limited to 2.5 hours on Sunday afternoons. Sometimes he would demonstrate how to string a bow or chip arrowheads. He constructed wooden drill rods he had used to make fire. Kroeber took him for car rides to the ocean, and he practiced archery in Golden Gate Park. A newspaper invited him to attend a vaudeville show at the Orpheum Theater. Ishi accepted and sat in the front row of the balcony box seats, and he laughed along with the crowd when a rhyming performer on stage declared, "And sitting in the box you see the Indian from the university." He learned to tie a four-in-hand cravat after a single demonstration. He refused to be photographed naked. He was fascinated by penny whistles, kaleidoscopes, and matches. He learned a little English, which he used with an unpredictable sort of flair. When a lady asked him if he believed in God, he said, "Sure, Mike." For the next 5 years, scientists studied almost everything about him. They marveled at the way he walked barefoot in the woods without snapping twigs underfoot. He springs from the great toe, which is wonderfully strong in its plantar flexion and abduction, wrote Dr. Saxton Pope. His method of locomotion is that of rather short steps, each foot sliding along the ground as it touches. Neither the heel nor the ball of the foot seems to receive the jar of the step. The foot is placed in position cautiously, not slammed or jammed down. He progresses rather pigeon-toed. 4.5 years after he was discovered, Ishii died in the museum of tuberculosis. Kroeber believed that Ishii wouldn't have wanted his body dissected in an autopsy, and he requested that his remains be cremated. He feared that Ishii might become even more of a curiosity piece after death than he'd been in life. "We have hundreds of Indian skeletons that nobody ever comes near to study," Kroeber explained upon Ishii's death. "The prime interest in this case would be of a morbid, romantic interest." He had good reason to be concerned, because history was full of stories of native survivors who had been sentenced to macabre afterlives on Earth. The last surviving native Tasmanian man, for example, was alternately dug up and reburied after his death in 1869 by physicians who believed he was a missing link between humans and apes. One doctor cut the head off the Tasmanian's corpse, another the hands and feet, another the ears and nose. They kept the body parts as souvenirs. One of the doctors used the tribesman's skin to make a tobacco pouch. Kroeber's request went unheeded, and doctors performed the autopsy. A San Francisco newspaper published a poem to the late Mr. Ishii a week after his death. "You did not fit. Your ways were other. This madhouse life was all too strange. It was a shame they found you, brother." For years, rumors circulated that Ishii's brain had been acquired by the Smithsonian Institution. The rumors were true. In 1999, the brain was discovered pickled in ethyl alcohol in a Maryland storage facility for the National Museum of Natural History. Responding to public outcry, the Smithsonian shipped the brain to members of the Redding Rancheria and Pitt River tribe, deemed to be descendant relatives of the Yahi. Ishii's brain was buried in a private ceremony in Deer Creek Canyon in August 2000. Sidney Pozuelo knew that when it came to gracefully shepherding last tribesmen out of the wilderness and into modern life, those in charge almost always screwed it up. History's list of people who have endured the kind of isolation in which the lone Indian had been living was extremely short, but there was one man still alive who came close to experiencing a similar depth of solitude. Sidney happened to know him well. His name was Carapiru, an Indian who was separated from the rest of his tribe in northeastern Brazil after settlers opened fire on his village and then burned it in 1978. As far as Sidney was concerned, what happened to Carapiru after that separation provided rare proof that the modern world had the capacity to get things right every now and then. If fate cooperated, the clash of civilizations didn't always have to end in tragedy. Carapiru's tribal village was near a coffee-colored stream in the northern state of Maranhão, and its destruction was swift. A group of settlers attacked and shot several tribe members and sent the few survivors scattering in different directions through the woods. Only one survivor was found, a boy of about 8 years old who had gotten entangled in a barbed wire fence after fleeing the village. A local Funai post took custody of him, placing him with other Indians on a nearby reservation. Carapiru had been alone in the forest at the time of the attack. After he saw that his village had been ransacked and destroyed, he began walking through the woods with no plan other than to survive. For 10 years he walked, south through the wooded hills of northern Brazil, all the way to a town called Angical in the state of Bahia. He walked more than 900 miles in all. During those years, he avoided civilization as much as he could, though often he found himself skirting towns and settlements, walking along railroad tracks, crossing roads. He carried his bows and arrows and a straw pack that held two cooking pots, a rubbing stick to make fire, and an alternating collection of other necessities. In October 1988, the residents of Anjikal, a modest town of simple brick houses, heard a squealing pig dashing madly through the town. A long wooden arrow was sticking out of its side. The people in town knew the arrow was a sign that there was an Indian nearby. It made sense. For weeks, the townspeople had noticed that some of their animals, pigs and chickens mostly, had gone missing. If an Indian was lurking outside of the village preying on their animals, they wanted to find him. They organized a search party and fanned out across the countryside. They found Karapiro in the bush. Instead of resisting their advance, he easily could have fled. He actually seemed happy to see them. He smiled as they approached. He surrendered his bow and arrows without complaint. They walked him into their neighborhood of houses and clothed his naked body in a pair of shorts. He accepted their food and smiled as the men, women, and children crowded around to get a good glimpse of a real wild Indian. It wasn't long before Funai got word of the story. Agency officials weren't sure what to do other than call Sidney, who had founded the Isolated Indians Division a year earlier, in 1987. Sidney wasn't sure what to do either, but he was more than game to meet the Indian. With another Sertanista, Wellington Gomez Figueiredo, Sidney drove to Anjikal and found Karapiro living among the residents. At first, the Indian's tribal identity was a mystery. Years earlier, Sidney had endured a grueling 37-day expedition through the virgin rainforest of the state of Maranhão to find members of the remote Awaguaja tribe. When he saw Karapiro, he suspected the Indian might be Awaguaja. Karapiro's language sounded similar, and his hair had a slight curl to it, an uncommon feature among most Brazilian Indians, but not unheard of among the Awaguaja. They couldn't leave Karapiro in the village, and with nowhere else to take him, the two Sertanistas loaded Karapiro in Sidney's car and drove him back to Brasilia, about 220 miles away. As they drove past fields and farms and eventually made their way into a city of 2.5 million people, both Wellington and Sidney wondered what Karapiro might have been thinking. Without the ability to understand his language, they could only guess. But Sidney was pretty sure Karapiro had to feel overwhelmed by the urban landscape unfolding before his eyes. Of all the cities in the world, none could have seemed more otherworldly to someone unaccustomed to the modern world than Brasilia. The capital had been created from scratch in the early 1960s between Sputnik and the Jetsons to be the city of the future. And its uncompromisingly modernist architecture prompted Australian art critic Robert Hughes to label it a utopian horror. But Sidney believed that because the country's foremost ethnological experts and indigenous services were based in Brasilia, it was the best place to bring him, at least for a couple of weeks, until Funai officials could determine exactly where the Indian belonged. Karapiro absorbed it all in silent wonder, staring wordlessly out the window as they approached the boxy high-rise apartment building where Sidney lived with his wife, daughter, and youngest son. For the next couple of weeks, the sixth-floor unit would be Karapiro's home, too. Inside the apartment, Sidney rifled through his closet and dressed Karapiro in a blue button-down shirt. Karapiro stood in front of one of the windows and spit at the glass, amazed at its transparency. Tap water was a miracle. The television seemed to be almost too much to handle. He didn't pay much attention to it, watching the family's reactions to the screen more than the screen itself. Sidney's wife and their housekeeper helped Karapiru into the shower, slowly rubbing him with soap. Sidney used the toilet to show Karapiru what the porcelain bowl was for and how it spirited away the dirty water with a flush. At dinner, they introduced him to cups, spoons, and forks, helping him cut his meat. Sidney's 3-year-old son, Orlando, made fast friends with Karapiru. Orlando was accustomed to being around Indians. It wasn't unusual for a house guest at the Pozuelo apartment to wear a feathered headdress or a wooden plate that stretched the lower lips into the shape of a tea saucer. But Orlando had never had a housemate like Karapiru, a constant companion who never seemed to tire of play. When Sidney went to the Funai office during the day, Karapiru would play with Orlando in the living room, watching Tom and Jerry cartoons. Orlando would burst into a children's song, and Karapiru would accompany him on percussion, banging a spoon on the table. Sidney's wife would watch them play together and imagine what the life Karapiru had left behind must have been like. The way he behaved with Orlando and her daughter, Fernanda, she figured that Karapiru must have had a family of his own once upon a time. Karapiru couldn't sleep in a bed, so Sidney strung a hammock for him in the spare bedroom. About 2 weeks after Karapiru moved in with them, Sidney noticed a foul smell coming from the room. Sidney guessed it might have been old food. During the first meals they had served him, he observed Karapiru hoarding meat, wrapping it in his shirt tail to carry back to his room. He stopped doing that after they explained that he could simply go to the kitchen for food anytime he was hungry. Sidney searched the room for a stash of rotting food, looking in closets, under piles of clothes, in the corners, and found nothing. Yet the smell persisted. Finally, Sidney looked out the window. Several feet below the window, a concrete ledge protruded from the building. A large pile of human excrement, about 2 weeks' worth, as it happened, sat moldering on the ledge in the sun. Karapiru had been dropping it out the window. Sidney couldn't reach the ledge to clean it, so he ran a hose from the bathroom to wash it away, creating a literal shitstorm as the muddied water ran down the side of the high-rise. The neighbors below them were not pleased. As soon as Karapiru had arrived in Brasilia, Funai began trying to determine what tribe he might have come from and called in specialists to listen to his speech patterns. Specialists with the Summer Institute of Linguistics, a United States-based nonprofit that documents languages around the world, said he was probably from the Awakanoeru tribe from central Brazil, though Sidney maintained he was probably Awaguaja. Sidney had tried to contact an Awaguaja tribe member named Gay to ask him to come to Brasilia, but he couldn't find him. The only Awaguaja speaker Funai could find was a boy about 18 years old. He also spoke Portuguese, having spent most of his life on a reserve in Maranhão. The people there called the boy Benvindu, the Portuguese word for welcome. "Benvindu is his name?" Sidney said over the phone to a Funai agent in Maranhão. "Benvindu. Okay, then, listen. Get on the first bus that leaves São Luís and come here. I'll pick you both up at the bus station." When Benvindu was introduced to Karapiru, they understood each other well. They seemed to share a deeper bond than a simple language. Benvindu locked eyes with Karapiru and stared at him silently for a full 30 seconds before turning to Sidney. "I recognize this man's face," Benvindu said. Sidney was surprised, but he figured the story wasn't so outlandish. If Karapiru was Awaguaja, then it wasn't out of the question that Benvindu might have come from the same village and recognized Karapiru from his youth. But the boy continued, and the story got stranger. "I think he's my father." They bore a striking physical resemblance, but Sidney didn't believe it. The coincidence was too wild. Sidney asked him if there was any way to prove it, if he remembered anything distinctive about his father. Benvindo said his father had a scar on his back, just below the halfway point on his spine. The two of them lifted Karapiru's t-shirt. Sidney saw a scar, exactly where Benvindo had described it. The linguists from the Summer Institute were skeptical when they were told the story. They believed that Benvindu's story must have been a case of wishful thinking. The specialists stuck to their theory that Karapiru came from the Awa Kanoeru. To solve the matter, Funai found Portuguese speakers from that tribe and brought them to Brasilia to try to talk with Karapiru. Benvindu also attended the meeting. Television stations covered the meeting as if it were a sports event. "I couldn't understand anything," Butikal, one of the Awa Kanoeru Indians, told a television reporter after listening to Karapiru speak. "I just heard gibberish." But Benvindu understood everything. Anthropologists agreed that Karapiru was, in fact, an Awa Gwaja Indian. He was from the same destroyed village that Benvindu had fled as an 8-year-old when he was discovered in a nearby field impaled in barbed wire fencing. Karapiru accepted the son that he thought he had lost forever. A few days later, Sidney accompanied Karapiru on a journey to the Karu Indian Reserve, where Benvindu had been relocated shortly after he'd been found. They flew to Maranhão, then paddled in a canoe down the Pindaré River toward the reserve. At noon, the couple dozen Indians who lived there gathered around Karapiru, who smiled in wonder as they sang welcoming songs. A decade after he set out on his own, Karapiru was back among Indians, though only one was from his own tribe. The transition to his new life wasn't easy. Shortly after moving into the reserve, he built his own hut in the forest, slightly removed from the village where the others lived. In his 50s now, Karapiru is considered a living example of how an isolated Indian can emerge from solitude and readapt to community if handled properly. He still lives on the grounds of the reserve, maintains a close relationship with Benvindu, and is friendly with the Indians from the other tribes. But sometimes he'll disappear into the forest for up to a week at a time. The Funai officials in charge of the reserve say they think he sometimes hungers for the solitude he had learned to live with for so long. After Sidney founded Funai's Isolated Indians Division, he earned an international reputation as the face of Brazil's policy of non-contact. The movie Amazon, shown worldwide in IMAX theaters, featured Sidney as an iconic protector of isolated cultures. National Geographic had run a cover story about one of his expeditions and quoted him as saying, "Once you make contact, you begin the process of destroying their universe." In 1998, Time magazine named him a hero for the planet. The New York Times magazine described him as a lone voice in the wilderness, waging an almost single-handed war against opponents who believed isolated Indians should be incorporated into society at large. The article continued, "But for all his savvy, Pozuelo stands practically alone, in his own way, isolated as much as the Indians he tracks. He too belongs to a vanishing breed. There are fewer than a dozen sertanistas in all of Brazil worthy of the name," he said, "who did not get their titles as political rewards, and many of them would just as soon see his project disappear. Indeed, it is impossible to imagine Pozuelo's vision without Pozuelo. Pozuelo knows that his critics include not only industrialists, politicians, generals, and academics, but also fellow sertanistas. Like that of the anthropologists, their glory has always grown from presenting new cultures to the rest of the world as if they had given birth to them. Yet as impossible as his quest may seem, Pozuelo is determined to change people's minds. I'm proposing the exact opposite," Pozuelo said. "I say your glory is in not discovering them." But in the case of the lone Indian in Rondônia, Marcello and Altair had been fiercer advocates for non-contact than Sidney. He believed that the threat to the Indians' environment was so severe that risking contact had become an unfortunate necessity. Relocation to another reserve had worked for Karapiru, and Sidney thought it might work in this case. Sidney was in charge of finding a replacement for Altair to lead the efforts to resolve the lone Indian's dilemma. The sensitivity of the Indian's situation demanded that someone dedicate himself fully to the task. But Sidney didn't trust many of the agency's Sertanistas to do the job right. He needed someone to uphold the Pozuelo vision. Eventually, he decided that to find that person, he needed only look a few doors down the hallway in his own home. Orlando Pozuelo, the son whom Sidney had named in honor of the greatest Sertanista he'd ever known, was only a teenager. But Sidney had been a teenager when he'd boarded that mail plane and headed to Mato Grosso. In his son, Sidney spotted the same itchy, adventurous spirit that had guided his life, as if it had been passed on in the blood. The kid knew the outdoors. He'd spent more time in the jungle before he hit puberty than a lot of explorers do in a lifetime. And his experience with Indians had been, to say the least, one of a kind. Sidney knew that if the lone Indian could hang on for just a year or so for Orlando to finish high school, then Sidney would be able to appoint the perfect person to head a newly energized ethno-environmental protection front in Hondonia. In the months after Altair was dismissed, Sidney kept an eye on the situation in Hondonia, overseeing a team that made sure the Indians' land wasn't destroyed. A little more than a year later, Sidney began taking Orlando with him on Funai expeditions, grooming him for a leadership position in the isolated Indians division. By the time he was 20 years old, in late 2004, Orlando Pozuelo became the team leader in charge of the expeditions to contact the lone Indian. Orlando boarded a plane for Hondonia. It landed safely, without the drama that his father had experienced when he'd embarked on his first journey as a Sertanista in training. Still, Orlando's flight also was the beginning of a great adventure. Chapter 13. One More Shot. Orlando Pozuelo was just getting settled in Hondonia, and already he was flat on his back in a hospital bed. His temperature had started the climb the morning he rented a house to serve as the Guaporé Ethno-Environmental Protection Front's new headquarters. While he was driving across the muddy roads and back to the Rio Omere camp for the night, he broke out in a drenching sweat. After trudging across a sloppy trail to the main hut, he filled a bath bucket with cold water and sat down in it. It didn't help. He skipped dinner and tried to sleep. His whole body clenched with pain. Throughout the night, he hauled himself to the bathroom again and again. The romance of a jungle adventure. This wasn't it. Orlando was worried that he might have dengue fever, a potentially fatal mosquito-borne disease that had been tearing through Brazil with unusual ferocity in 2004 and early 2005, sickening people from Rio to Hondonia. He suffered through another day and sleepless night in the camp, then climbed in the truck to drive to a small hospital in the town of Jiparaná. His neck was so sore he could barely turn his head. At the hospital, the doctor told him he wasn't going to let him leave in such a sorry condition, and the nurses prepared a bed for him. The room wasn't terrible. If it were a hotel, it probably would be the nicest in town. He had his own bathroom and color TV. There was even a little mini bar by the wall. But a hospital bed, no matter how comfortable, was a long way from where he wanted to be. For weeks, he'd been studying the reports that Marcello and Altair had written from previous expeditions in search of the lone Indian, and he was planning to launch one of his own. He got to know the lay of the land around the interdicted area. He even put together a new team of explorers. He was itching for a real woodland adventure, but for now, The closest thing to excitement he could muster was flipping through the pages of The Da Vinci Code between naps. Orlando wasn't accustomed to inactivity, and normally he was the picture of rude health. He was toned and tanned. His dark hair fell in natural ringlets. His cheekbones were high-ridged, and his jaw was sharply chiseled. He wore a dark stud earring. His natural bashfulness charmed girls, and his romantic entanglements were already complicating his life significantly. Before he left Brasilia, he'd gotten a girl pregnant. He supported her decision to have the baby and genuinely was excited about the prospect of being a father, but he had made it clear that he wasn't going to drop everything and become a full-time family man. He had a new career, one he practically had been raised for, and he knew very well that the job demanded one thing above all else, a willingness to cut yourself off from family and friends and spend time in a place that was a long, long way from home. His own father had taught him that this line of work could be rough on a person's love life, but good things don't come without a price. Orlando believed the rewards outweighed the drawbacks. He relished the idea of testing his skills against the jungle, and this was supposed to be his chance. During the interim between Altair's departure and Orlando's arrival, Sidney had appointed a man named Moacir Cordeiro de Mello to serve as acting chief of the Protection Front. And in that time, the lone Indian's situation appeared to worsen. The congressional investigations into Marcelo's actions hadn't resulted in any change in the status of the state's Indian territories, but it had emboldened the local ranchers and politicians. In 2003, the governor of Hondonia flatly stated to a Spanish television station that no isolated Indians existed in his state. If anyone found isolated tribes in Hondonia, he said it was because they had been taken from Bolivia and planted here by FUNAI's own agents. Illegal logging on Indian territories increased. Even Celso de Sordi, the owner of the Sosel ranch who'd made the pact with Altair when threatened by the squatters from the MST, had started grumbling about the idea of curbing development to protect the lone Indian. His relatives had spoken with FUNAI agents to complain about the Indian, saying they were eager to convert the forest to farmland. Now that the squatting threat had passed, so had the rancher's enthusiasm for protecting the Indian, it seemed. Moacir initially agreed with Sidney that contact should be made with the Indian before it was too late. He organized a couple of small trips into the forest, but they were unsuccessful. After those expeditions, Moacir had a change of heart. Soon, his official dispatches to FUNAI's headquarters in Brasilia indicated that he was racked with doubts. His experience in Hondonia had led him to believe that Marcelo and Altair had arrived at the correct conclusion. Forcing contact with the Indian wouldn't do any good. In 2004, just before Sidney sent Orlando to Hondonia, Moacir wrote Sidney a letter that he marked Maximum Urgency. He wrote that his two unsuccessful expeditions had caused the Indian to abandon yet another of his huts, and it appeared that he had fled to the southeastern edge of the temporarily interdicted area. If they continued to press for contact, Moacir feared that the Indian would flee the interdicted area altogether and end up in a territory that was totally unprotected. Not only had the Indian rejected the gifts they had laid out for him, but he had also gone out of his way to destroy them. Moacir wrote, "Clearly his message is one of warning. If we could understand these messages, always delivered through these communications of escape and rejection, wouldn't he probably be saying, 'Leave me in peace'?" However, Sidney remained convinced that contact was the only way to protect the Indian in the face of the threats from politicians and landowners. If FUNAI agents could somehow communicate with the Indian, they could inform him of the dangers he faced if he were to move out of the interdicted zone. A few weeks after he received Moacir's memo, Sidney sent Orlando to Hondonia to take over the efforts to contact the Indian. The day Orlando was released from the hospital, he began to prepare for an extended expedition to try to contact the Indian. Orlando wanted to venture out, for however long it took, until they found the man. When putting together an expedition team, Orlando started with Francisco Couto Limarosa, a 22-year-old whom everyone called Chico. All of the Funai field assistants who had worked for Marcelo and Altair had either quit or transferred to other regions, and Chico had been one of the replacements hired by Moacir. Orlando felt comfortable around Chico, partly because of his age. Orlando knew that some of the older guys who worked for Funai didn't like his father, and he assumed they probably grumbled about nepotism behind his back. But he didn't pick up any of those negative vibes from Chico. Orlando turned to him as a planning partner, in the same way that Marcelo had always turned to Altair. Two other assistants rounded out Orlando's new team. One was Francisco Mura, whom everyone called by the nickname Chiquinho, Little Chico. He was in his mid-twenties and didn't have much experience in the woods, but Orlando liked his attitude. The other was Celso José dos Santos, who went by the nickname Tunio. At 34, Tunio was the oldest member of the new team. He'd grown up in the area, on a farm outside the same town where Altair's family lived. In fact, it had been Altair who had hired Tunio's cousin a few years before to help out at the Rio Omare camp. When Moacir was looking for someone to assist with an expedition the previous year, his cousin recommended Tunio. With just 1 year under his belt with Funai, Tunio also had more seniority than anyone else on Orlando's expedition team. Within a month after his release from the hospital, Orlando launched his first expedition with Chico, Chiquinho, and Tunio. Just before they left, the results from his blood tests came back. The doctors told Orlando that he had been infected with leishmaniasis, an insect-borne disease that, if left untreated, can cause skin sores that resemble leprosy, and can even kill a person by destroying his spleen, liver, or bone marrow. Before he left for the jungle and the hunt for the lone Indian, Orlando packed the intravenous medicine the doctor prescribed for him. The hospitalization seemed like little more than another checkmark on Orlando's resume, one of the uncomfortable but necessary hurdles any self-respecting explorer has to get over to earn the title. Leishmaniasis wasn't malaria, but it was close. The search wasn't going well. They had been in the forest for exactly a month, from March 12th to April 12th of 2005, and they had found nothing. Not a glimpse of the man, not a footprint, not a trace. They had found one old hut and spent several days camping beside it before they determined that it had been permanently abandoned. Of all the members of the team, none was riddled with more uncertainty than Tunio. He respected Orlando's enthusiasm, but he didn't believe Orlando had enough experience to be the team leader. Tunio and some of the other Funai workers who'd been on Moacir's team sometimes poked fun at their new boss, chuckling at stories about how Orlando had flipped his canoe when he visited the Masako Indian Reserve in another part of the state. Some of the guys had grumbled that all Orlando knew about jungle exploration was how to use a GPS. Tunio had grown up in a shack on the edge of the forest, the youngest of eight children, and he'd spent his whole life exploring the woods. He confessed to his colleagues that Orlando hadn't earned his respect yet. But even more troubling than his doubts about his leader, Tunio wasn't convinced that the object of their search was real. With Moacir, he'd gone on a 10-day expedition the year before on the lone Indian's land, and they hadn't found a single trace of the man. Tunio had only heard stories about the Indian. He'd never seen the pictures Vincent had taken, or the actual artifacts his predecessors had collected. By the time he had spent a month with Orlando in the forest, Tunio had started to seriously doubt that the man actually existed. These expeditions had begun to seem like an Amazonian version of a wild goose chase. He needed to see to believe. Within a week, he would get his chance. Orlando and his team hiked all day, every day, and usually they camped wherever they happened to be when the daylight ran out. Each night they strung their hammocks and tarps in a different part of the forest. Food was short, and together they decided that if they ran out, two members of the team would leave to fetch more, and two would stay. On the morning of April 12, 2005, the team decided that they liked the campsite they had found enough to stay there for one more night. They planned to walk all day, then return to the same spot late in the afternoon. They spent the entire day hiking, and on the way back, at about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, they spotted a gouge in the side of a tree trunk. It was a fresh slash, no more than a couple of days old. The honey oozing out of the tree's wound was fresh. They searched the immediate area for tracks, but didn't find any. Daylight was fading. They decided that they should head back to their camp before it got dark, and Chico suggested that they travel a different route than they had taken to get there. If the Indian perhaps had seen them at some point during the day and fled, they'd have a better chance of encountering him if they cut a new trail back instead of the one they'd used before. Orlando marked the coordinates of the honeycut in his handheld GPS, and they began to walk back toward the camp. The slightly roundabout route they took led them across a stream. On the bank, they found a clear human footprint. A small amount of water had filled the print. The water in the print was muddy. It hadn't had time to settle, which meant the print was fresh. It probably was only hours old. The footprint seemed small to Chico. "There are four of us and only one of him," he said. "If we find him, we could probably capture him if we wanted to." The others weren't sure if he was being serious, but after a month of long hikes and no clues, they began to consider the idea that contact was a real possibility. Chico's suggestion of taking action after confronting him was a novel one. The idea hadn't occurred to Orlando. He simply thought that they'd try to confront the Indian, wait for him to react, and respond instinctively. Orlando entered the site of the footprint in his GPS, and they walked back to their camp in silence, scanning for signs of life along the way. For the next 5 days, they searched the area, but returned to the camp each afternoon having found nothing. On the morning of April 18th, they passed around a plastic thermos of instant coffee and some biscuits, and agreed to make the most of the day. Instead of playing it safe and returning to the camp in the middle of the afternoon, they'd search until dusk. They packed some rice and farofa, figuring they'd hunt for meat if they needed to make a full meal. With a full day of hiking in front of them, they were careful not to weigh themselves down with anything but the bare necessities. Tunio brought along a tiny miner's headlamp that he could use if it started to get dark before they made it back. They walked all morning, looking through the trees for signs, but not finding any. At about noon, they spotted a stand of manioc plants and some corn in the middle of the forest. Orlando was ecstatic. They would wait for the Indian all afternoon, if necessary. When they spotted a group of wild pigs nearby, they took advantage of the opportunity for a good meal. Chico quietly followed the animals a short distance through the woods until he got a clear shot. A few minutes later, he returned with the carcass of a boar. With plenty of food for a big evening meal, he suggested they spend the rest of the day right there, at the side of the plantation. Orlando was supposed to be the leader of the group, but he felt as if he had been deferring to the older guys too much. He needed to try to assert some control. "I can't," Orlando said. "I left my leishmaniasis medicine back at the camp." Chico protested, arguing that they'd surely find him if they stayed, and Orlando let the matter drop. They would wait, and if Chico felt the same way by the end of the afternoon, they could debate the matter then. In the meantime, they divided the meat from the pig into fourths. With nowhere to store it, each of them carried his portion spiked atop a stick. They searched around the plantation for more Indian tracks. They didn't have to search long. A short distance away, they found a hut in a small clearing amid a tall stand of manioc plants. They couldn't see if the Indian was inside the hut, so they split into groups of